From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The new millennium has not been kind so far. America has been whacked from all sides. 9/11, anthrax, American Taliban, shoe bombers, sniper, war drums, fear, and now the space shuttle Columbia in pieces just out of the blue. Today in Houston, President Bush led the nation in solemn tribute. But how is the country sorting out all the trauma? As lucky a nation as it is, America has known plenty of loss and anguish. But lately, events are piling on when we did not expect them. And in an era when the media is always ready to crank up the emotion and linger on the sorrow, and yet the traumas are real. How are we, how are you, coping? Has trauma made us wiser, more compassionate, more vulnerable to manipulation, or just numb? Tonight on Point, national trauma and the American response. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Carolyn Marvin, professor of communications at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. Good evening and welcome, Carolyn Marvin.
Hi, nice to be here.
It's great to have you back, Carolyn. And with us from Portland, Oregon is Arthur Neal, author of National Trauma and Collective Memory, Major Events in the American Century, and professor emeritus at Portland State University. Good evening and welcome, Professor Neal.
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Yeah, as am I. Carolyn Marvin, we all no doubt saw pictures on the television today of what's going on in Houston, and it's impossible not to feel the blow of this last 3 days in a kind of drum roll, in a kind of sequence of blows here. We want to dig in tonight and ask how we're coping with this. Are we doing well? Are we doing poorly? How are we bearing up? What's your top line view, Carolyn Marvin?
Well, I think you're right about the repetition of this particular event, but there's a certain comfort in that, in a funny way, because we have been through some things like this before, and we know a lot really now about what to do. The media knows what to do. The public knows what to do. And this doesn't make it less sad. But we do have a frame to put around it. And it's not a morally ambiguous frame. There's not any criminal activity here, as far as anybody knows. These were astronauts that knew what the risk was. This is not a group that was fighting on board. So the moral circumstances in which it takes place are pretty blameless. And so that leaves us free to grieve and to use the formulas that we have that are very good formulas for comfort and solace.
I guess absolutely no one tonight is suggesting anything other than tribute and honor to the astronauts who died there. Nothing of the sort. It's really this repetition of moments of grief and even that formula that you describe that I'm wondering about, and whether how grief mounts up, how we hold it collectively. When you have trauma upon top of trauma upon trauma, does it turn into something else? And does it ultimately become something where the formula itself may tempt to kind of spiral into grief? The media may push beyond what's right.
Well, you know, I think there is a level of grief beyond which it's very hard to go for a society. I don't think there's really a formula for that exactly. But I also think that in the process of because we've been through the Challenger, we've been through the Kennedy assassination, one of the messages here is the group goes on. And there's a certain comfort in that. We look around and we see that we still want the task as a society of trying to push into areas where nobody's ever been before. And that's our comfort, that the group is not gone, but the group is bigger because of the effort that these people have made. So that's our final comfort, is that the group is okay.
Arthur Neal, you've got the real long view here. The group is getting uncomfortably accustomed to expressions of grief and moments of fear in the last couple of years. How do you see the current American way of responding in a longer historical context? How are we coping with this rain of blows, at least that's what it feels like since 9/11, compared to how Americans have coped in previous times of trauma?
Well, I agree only partially with what's been said, because I really think that for a condition to become a trauma, there has to be a certain amount of shock and disbelief connected with it. So in terms of the long-range view on this, there's certain patterns that are fairly easy to identify. Mm-hmm. If you trace it back to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the Cuban Missile Crisis, mm-hmm. Kennedy's assassination, mm-hmm. That sort of thing. And the pattern is essentially this, that there is initial shock and disbelief and incredulity, and this is followed then by all segments of the population being drawn into the event. And when this happens, the news sources are always inadequate, and people get together in small groups all over the country to discuss what happened, how did it happen, what are the implications for the nation, what's going to happen next. And it's also associated with very intense emotional reactions collectively, including, in this case, particularly collective sadness. In others, it's been associated with collective fear, as with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And also collective anger is very much a part of it. So there are these identifiable patterns that that go along with all of the major forms of trauma of the 20th century. But I'm not sure that we're ever really prepared for it. I think it's correct that there have been precedents for what happened over the weekend, namely all the way back to the sinking of the Titanic, the mm-hmm. explosion of the Hindenburg, the Challenger shuttle explosion is the closest analogy. So I think there are some basic similarities.
Arthur Neal, I guess we're always tempted to see ourselves as in a unique historical moment. You describe patterns that have held true throughout the 20th century. I'm just wondering if in the 21st century we're seeing something new in the American response or not. If we look at the whole knot of events and incidents going back to and including 9/11, and the way they are now tied up with 24-hour media and the media as the kind of medium for our shared collective emotion, fear, how would you compare the United States over the last now year and a half since 9/11 and its the American culture's response in that media-driven era to what we saw in earlier eras? Is it the same? Is it different?
Well, it's different in this way, that the world has become much more complex. It's become more technologically sophisticated. So when we consider Lincoln's assassination, 150 years ago, it was more than 2 weeks before the news reached all parts of the country. So today there is instantaneous communication through the mass media, and the whole nation becomes drawn into tragic events very quickly. So it's this speed with which the nation and the entire world becomes involved in events.
There's an issue of speed. Is there also an issue of immersion, media immersion?
In what sense?
Well, in the sense that I'm imagining, I can remember clearly at the time of the Kennedy assassination, I could only imagine in Lincoln's time, many conversations revolved around those events, and they revolved around them for weeks and days. But there was not, certainly not before the Kennedy assassination, the equivalent of the unending television bath of emotion.
Yeah, so television really makes a major difference. And it was the Kennedy assassination that was the first time that the entire nation could be drawn into an event in the same way.
Can I disagree just a little with that?
Carolyn Marvin.
It's certainly true that the Kennedy assassination was important in that way, but as a child, I remember those space shots. And, mm-hmm. in fact, the networks spent hours and hours and hours covering them. And I think it's so interesting to look at the tapes of that earlier era, which I have done a little of, because you can watch television learning how to do these long-term media events. And in those early days, they're quite awkward. It's very apparent from our point of view now. I mean, I remember ABC watching a tape of a young Sam Donaldson asking for crowd reactions to the early space shots, and people don't quite say the right things, and so Sam Donaldson kind of gives them a line, you know, and Howard K. Smith assembles Marshall McLuhan and the young Bill Moyers and other public intellectuals, James Dickey, the poet, and in a sort of an awkward way, James Dickey reads a poem about outer space. So even though the Kennedy assassination, I think, certainly marks that first coordinated media effort over several days, which has a lot of grief associated with it. In fact, the early space shots were precisely the first big television events that drew the whole nation in for hours at a time.
But Carolyn Marvin, let me ask you this. Is it a sign of progress that now, in whatever far corner of the United States, in that distant cow pasture in Texas, where the microphone and the camera are produced, everybody knows exactly what to say? Does that mean that we're doing a better job of coping, of processing what's going on in reality, or simply that we've all become kind of part of a mutual back-scratching media formula, media dynamic?
Well, I think something that you're kind of pointing to is really true, and that is the media, of course, is relentless, and it needs images, and it needs words all the time, and so it reaches out for all kinds of events. We're always looking, in that sense, for a sacrifice, but some events that we have really are worthy of that kind of attention, and in that sense, I think the media does have a learning curve and has learned to do some things very well. I mean, it was interesting to me, for example, that in the coverage, as far as I can tell, of both radio and television, people refused to say, for example, on air, what was clearly apparent, which was that the astronauts were dead, until that moment when the flags were lowered to half staff. Now, I think that's quite interesting because that's a rejection of news values, which would try and break the story first, to a kind of deference to ritual procedures that, you know, there's kind of needs to be a collective moment of acknowledging that these souls, you know, these human lives are gone. And so in that sense, I think really there is some learning. But that doesn't change the fact that for some other kinds of events that are less worthy, there's this kind of sort of awful, relentless effort to bump them up to a status that they don't truly deserve.
Arthur Neal, when you look at the last year and a half in historical terms, are we in a period, an extended period of national trauma or not? Does it rise to that level? We have 9/11, we have the talk of war without end, of threat without end, and then we all know the kind of parade of events right up to this weekend's Columbia that have occurred since 9/11. Are we in a period of national trauma?
I would say in answer to that, the answer is yes. And it's in part because of the increased technological sophistication of modern society, that you simply could not develop sophisticated forms of technology without increasing the vulnerability to disruption. So, you know, everything from the sinking of the Titanic to the more recent tragedy, it involves dealing with extremely complex technological systems. And if you increase the complexity, you also increase the susceptibility to being vulnerable.
The parallel to that, then, we understand the vulnerability of technology, but what about the vulnerability of the psyche in that environment? Are we collectively, individually up to this? Are we having the stiff upper lip? Are we wallowing? How are we doing?
Well, I don't think we're doing very well. We're doing pretty well in terms of being able to share in the collective sadness, as we did during 9/11, because it does have a unifying effect when you have millions of people that are drawn into these tragic events, and it does lead to tuning up national values. But at the same time, it also increases the sense of collective fear within the general population. We become much more fearful because we really aren't sure what's going to happen next, and we feel much more vulnerable than we did in the past.
We've got to take a short break. I want to come back and look at exactly that, about how we're handling the sense of trauma since 9/11. It's our subject tonight. We've had 9/11 and anthrax, the DC sniper, war drums, fear, now Columbia. How are we handling all this? How traumatized are we? Are you, really? Are we coping with the rain of blows? Are we coping well? Are we coping poorly? Does trauma bring out the best in American character? or something else? Are we showing toughness? Are we wallowing? Are we just getting by? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America and national trauma from 9/11 right on through this weekend's Columbia debacle. My guests tonight are Carolyn Marvin. She's professor of communications at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. And Arthur Neal, joining us tonight from Portland, Oregon, sociologist and professor emeritus at Portland State University. You can join us as well. Does the media mirror our emotions, or does it manufacture emotions you sometimes do not have? Do you have a sense of being besieged? Is that pulling the country together? Is it being manipulated? Is trauma making us wiser? Is it making us more compassionate? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jaffna is calling from Boston. Hi, Jaffna. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would just like to talk about the fear that I believe the media has created about the recent tragedies. I think that we're in a state of immersion in this fear, and I think that as a collective consciousness, we've allowed this fear to paralyze us, instead of throwing us into proactive decisions and proactive activities.
What's the evidence of paralysis, Jeffna?
Well, just, you know, media coverage where you hear people, you know, when I listen to the news, it's like people just talking in italics, and we have these banners, and we just have this product, and the tragedies are turned into commodities. And, you know, we have these empty statements of patriotism, flags on cars, when really we need to be more critical of our media, more critical of our leaders, and be conscientious consumers of that media.
Are you so sure that all those expressions of patriotism are empty? I mean, there's some substance there too, isn't there, Jeff?
I mean, I don't want to say that they're all empty, but I certainly try to engage in dialogue with people in my community and, you know, say what does the flag represent to them. And I think that a lot of people do it out of respect for 9/11, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we need to look past just that fear and that anger that we have about 9/11 and really start to examine what our leaders are doing, what we're going to allow them to do.
Jeffna, we've got it, and thank you so much for your call. I want to turn for an answer to a fresh guest, Toby Miller, joining us tonight from Riverside, California. He's professor of cultural studies at New York University. Good evening and welcome, Toby Miller.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks so much for being with us. Our caller, and I think you heard her just now, Toby, is concerned about a kind of national paralysis and concerned about tragedy being turned into a commodity. Do we run that risk in the media era?
I think that is a problem. You know, when you think back to take Pearl Harbor in the 40s or take the assassination of JFK in the 60s, there was a much simpler media system. Lots of radio stations, lots of newspapers, but in terms of television, when it comes to JFK, really very little. And you could argue that until the 1980s and deregulation, we had in our, you know, three-way commercial TV network system, a kind of national broadcaster like they have in Britain or Canada, the BBC, the CBC. Nowadays, since deregulation, we have a balkanized situation where there are all these different competing news channels. There are so many different sources. There's a brutal ratings war. There isn't the sense of being able to say, getting back to what you were talking about earlier, this is we, this is America, this is the United States.
But is that really so different? I mean, when the shock is great enough, don't Americans tend to converge around maybe not three anymore, but at most half a dozen stations? I remember an awful lot of conversation after 9/11 about how each of the three big network anchors had done, and people were very invested in the anchor who carried the tone that they found most informing, salving at that moment.
Well, it's certainly true that people turned back to the big three and to CNN, away from a more trivial news gathering like Fox has, and that those ratings held for a couple of weeks. But I think that that's a pretty fleeting event. We'll have to see what happens with the coverage of Columbia and the president's speech today. But I do think that the way that we can talk about the notion of an American population or a typical American is more complicated now because immigration opened up in the 60s, because race relations have changed so massively. The idea of there being a national psyche seems very problematic to me because it's a much richer, more multicultural society with people with very different backgrounds and histories, and not all just people who want to look back at the Second World War and say, here was a just conflict where the United States saved the world for liberty.
Yeah, it's definitely more complex, but there's something, there's some level at which we don't want to give up the idea of a national psyche. It's a kind of manifestation of the nation. But I want to ask you this. You're describing that earlier era of television coverage as somehow better. Carolyn Marvin looks to what has been learned in television in particular over the years and says, we handle it better now. We understand at that media level how to come out and confront a tragedy in a way that's more respectful. So where are we there? Are we better off or not, Toby Miller?
Well, my concern is rather like the caller's. I hear what Carolyn's saying, and I think that the coverage that I saw on several networks was mostly respectful. I thought MSNBC was rather mistaken in having a split-screen effect where they had press conferences from NASA on one side of the screen and, as it were, home video footage of the now-dead astronauts on the other. I thought that was very unfortunate.
Or to be precise, that endlessly falling debris, the endlessly falling...
No, this wasn't the endlessly falling debris. This was actually home video footage of them in on board.
Oh, I see. Oh, gee.
I thought that was very unfortunate because I thought it really rather trivialized things.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, though, there have been so many traumas that are covered so often that, yes, something has been learned. My concern is whether or not, to get back to what the caller said, there's enough critical analysis. Because when Carolyn said, you know, this is not any kind of witch hunt or warlock hunt, and we can say that there's no fault at play. If you look at some media outlets, there's a lot of discussion of fault. There's discussion of groupthink at NASA, whereby dissident engineers were not listened to as late as last week. There are many people who are saying that the investment in staffed space flight and having astronauts on board is outmoded and gung-ho and macho. So there's a lot of criticism there that the mainstream media, I don't think, have actually dealt with all that thoroughly, maybe because they want to be respectful in what is, of course, a tragic national moment.
Toby Miller, Carolyn Marvin, Arthur Neal, please stand by. I want to welcome some more callers. And Mary's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine,
I don't know if I guess I'm wallowing. I'm one of the wallowers. I have found that I don't have TV anymore. I've totally cut it off after September 11th.
Why?
I don't read the newspaper anymore. I read the newspaper on Sunday. I read the New York Times, and that's it.
Because it's too much, Mary, or why?
It's too much. It's just too much. I was incredibly saddened by September 11th, and I thought, I can't watch one more special. I can't watch one more show. And then the only radio station I listen to is NPR, and I go to work and I don't listen to it then, so I only come home at night and listen to it.
But Mary, is it you're not listening, you're not watching because these tragedies are covered too well or not well enough?
It's covered too well. I was incredibly saddened all day Saturday, and you know, my neighbor said, "What is the matter with you on Sunday?" And I said, "I said this is just the saddest thing to happen since, you know, September 11th." And part of the sadness is that I think that people are becoming desensitized by this. I don't think that you know, you see it on TV and it's done and then okay, it's over with. I don't think that people really care. And last night when you had the woman on who was the principal of the school that the children had done the experiments
in Israel, yes.
In Israel, that was just heartbreaking. And I thought, I'm not going to turn this off because he's only going to have it on here for a few more minutes. And
so you're hanging on by your fingernails to that news flow. It's just too much sometimes.
It is. It really, really is.
Mary, thank you for your call. Arthur Neal, what's your sense of the tone and treatment that the media is giving these events?
Well, I was very interested in the caller's response because we found that in our studies of the major traumas going all the way back to Kennedy's assassination. And there were some of our subjects that described it as one of the most unifying, integrating experiences of their life. They were just simply drawn into a sense of national unity.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other people that just simply responded by saying that it was the most disorganizing experience of their life. They were responding to the chaos, the fear, the sadness, the disorganization, And they simply referred to this as simply an indication of all the things that's wrong with contemporary society.
Arthur Neal, when you look back on the super large American traumas, I don't know if it starts with the American Revolution, but certainly Civil War, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, maybe 9/11 is in these ranks. But looking back to the earlier ones, do these events leave a permanent stamp on the American mindset, or is it a scar that heals and goes away?
Well, this is why I was interested in the previous comment on the lack of a national unity, because I'm of the opinion that there is a strong sense of national unity, and we see that coming out on the 4th of July, which is a direct response to the American Revolution. We see it in terms of the emphasis upon the unity of the nation following the Civil War, and we also see it in the contemporary world order, in which we see the United States is in a position of leadership throughout the world. We came out of World War II strong economically and militarily, and we were simply thrust into a position of world leadership, despite our attempts to stay out of world affairs prior to World War II. So I think those traumas become central to who we are as Americans. And I think that while you have the diversity and the heterogeneity that's built into the system, that there is a sense of national unity that's superimposed on all of these other identities.
Carolyn Marvin, since 9/11, if each of these puts a stamp on the American mind, if we can think of it as in the singular, are we becoming the abused nation in our sense of ourselves?
Well, I mean, death is a real thing, and tragedies are a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
These are not, in that sense, media creations. These are facts. And I don't think anybody mm-hmm. is advising that we not talk about it.
Absolutely not.
The question is, how do you cope with these real, terrible things that happen? And
question.
Your caller that has just had enough, I am very sympathetic to her concerns. And, of course, the wonderful thing about media is, in fact, that you can turn them off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if one expects to have only experiences of media, that's not a life. You know, the media are there as background, and they're very important and they're informative. But as Art Neal says, it's these other experiences. It's the ability to have the memorial service in Houston. I mean, if that were only a media event in a studio, that's a real event that's going on, and that's useful for those people who are participating in it, and perhaps for the rest of us to some extent.
Real family members, real colleagues.
Yes, exactly. And so there's a variety of ways in which we try and process the meaning of events like this. And the media is one. The media is particularly important because, as Toby says, we are many different people with many different experiences, but there are some events that interest us all at some level. Now, I use the word advisedly when I say all, because not everybody, in fact, is equally interested. But there are some events that seem so important in terms of what they symbolize, in terms of effort and sacrifice for love and knowledge and this kind of thing, that we all can relate to them, and we want to have some media participation with them, and we would feel very odd if that weren't present. How much is enough, I think, is something that people have to decide on their own, and there certainly are many other kinds of ways of trying to cope with what these things mean.
And I'm still interested in this issue of whether the media hyper-oxygenates these moments. Yes, they're sad, but are they artificially somehow extended compared to what our ancestors would have given such traumas by the interest that the media has in keeping them going? Ray's calling. Welcome, Ray. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
You just made a point that really rings true to me. I really feel that it's a great tragedy to the people who died, and of course their families. You know, you don't want to lose a life like this, especially seven lives.
Never.
But these are scientists who took on an extremely dangerous job, and yes, something very bad happened, and nobody. I don't want to minimize for a moment the tragedy of what happened to these people and their families, but I really believe that that this isn't. This is nothing really more than a personal tragedy and a scientific loss, and that I think that people are really, maybe the media, and certainly and the public tends to be drawn into what the media does and says, but it seems to be made a lot more of, and they expect people to have great woe and sadness over something like this that I really don't think needs to be pushed that hard.
But Ray, that was more than just that wasn't just a piece of metal up there. I mean, didn't you feel the kind of national aspiration that a space shuttle carries? Don't you feel that moment that calls up a kind of collective, oh my God?
Oh, sure I do. Sure I do. And like any other American, and I would hope that most human beings around the planet, I would want the people in charge to investigate and try to make sure that what caused this never happens again. But by the same token, I think that as it being this incredible national tragedy, I look around. People are getting on with their lives. It certainly saddens people when you see it on when you're reminded by it on the television.
It's sad, but is it too much? Ray, we've got it. Thank you for your call. Toby Miller, how about it? It's a difficult thing to talk about, and yet I have to admit I had a couple of uncomfortable moments early on in the weekend when I felt in the tone of voice that maybe news presenters were putting on the long face and the theatrical response a little too eagerly. There, I felt an artifice that made me feel a bit uncomfortable, even as I was feeling sorrow.
Well, you know, Tom, I think that's a very interesting point. I feel a little bit sorry, actually, for the news presenters in that they're probably worried about exactly that response. They're thinking so much in a kind of double-think way. I am feeling sad now that I'm speaking here on behalf of the American people as their news anchor, but I'm worried about looking like I'm putting it on, and so how do you know what your real feelings are? But I wanted to get back to something that was raised by the call, which I think is important.
Yes.
If you think back to those times in the 60s and the early 70s, we can all remember waiting to see whether Apollo 13 would come down safely, and then it was memorialized in the film, of course. Carolyn mm-hmm. talked about those times.
Mm-hmm.
That was a period when the space race was really on, when the United States identified itself very thoroughly with this part of the Cold War. It had been JFK's promise that, you know, we'll put the first people on the moon before the Soviets. And I think what's happened in the intervening period is that since the Cold War ended in the last 10 years, NASA, and no doubt loss of a Challenger was an important part of this a bit earlier, NASA's lost that sense of being able to stand for a pioneering spirit.
So it wasn't the same national purpose that we all understood falling out of the sky. Carolyn Murphy, I just have you for a few more seconds before I know I have to let you go. We asked for your top line. Give us your bottom line. How are we doing? Are we holding up all right?
Well, I'll tell you that I think this is a very different ceremony than the one we're about to have. We are a nation that is thinking about death right now because of September the 11th, but also because of what may be about to happen with Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
These are morally complicated issues. One of the things about the Columbia disaster is that it is not morally complicated in quite that way.
So it gives us a moment to share that's simple, perhaps before an perhaps, we hope not, but before an onslaught
right.
of death. Carolyn Marvin, thank you so much for joining us.
You're
welcome. Carolyn Marvin joined us from Philadelphia. She's professor of communications at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about America and national trauma. How are we handling this? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America and national trauma after 9/11 and anthrax, the D.C. sniper, war drums, fear, now the Columbia breakup. How are we handling this? How traumatized are we? Are you? Are we coping with the rain of blows? Are we coping well? Are we coping poorly? Does trauma bring out the best in American character or something else? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Arthur Neal, joining us from Portland, Oregon. He's author of National Trauma and Collective Memory, Major Events in the American Century. And from Riverside, California tonight, Toby Miller, professor of cultural studies at New York University. You're welcome to join us as well. David's on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How
Hi.
Are you?
Fine, thanks.
I think I observed when Oklahoma City took place that there was a different type of coverage that took place in Oklahoma City, that we did not give it the overall media just focus focus everything on Oklahoma City the way we did 9/11 and even the Challenger and...
You're suggesting something with that. What is it, David?
I don't know. I'm asking the question. I don't know whether it's a matter of the media are based on the coasts or whether there has been a change since the time of Oklahoma City that we now are dealing with things differently. And I'd like to hear your guests and you address why it was treated differently.
Well, let's see if people think it was. I mean, I do remember clicking the television on that morning and the footage was right there. It did take a while for the mass media to descend on Oklahoma City, but maybe it was just so unsettling, so upsetting. We know how to cover, very sadly, shuttle disasters at this point. That was something new. Toby Miller, what's your sense? Was there a different treatment of Oklahoma City?
It's a very interesting question, Tom. I'm not in a position, having not done a comparative study, to say. But I do want to say one quick thing in response to David's call, and that is that if you think about what the World Trade Center and the Pentagon represented, the World Trade Center represented the power of New York finance capital for the world.
Very clearly.
And New York culture. Mm-hmm. The Pentagon represented the power of the United States military. Oklahoma City was a federal building, of course, but it was something in the heartland. And whilst the heartland might have a romantic resonance for people in this country, it's not what anybody would regard as the power center that cradles the nation's significance in the world.
Not a national icon, and in that way, confusing to interpret an attack on a federal building there, at least confusing in the early hours. Arthur Neal, what's your sense? I note that we haven't talked about Oklahoma City bombing until our caller David brought it up tonight. Did it get a different treatment? Why doesn't it roll naturally off the tongue as one of our traumas, our national traumas?
Well, so if I had published my book a couple years later, I would have included a chapter on that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's interesting about the media coverage, I was certainly intrigued with the comments by the last caller, where he pointed out that that there are some events that receive an overemphasis in the news media, and I've sort of been intrigued with the way in which the media covers the tragic death of celebrities. You know, if you look at the media coverage of the death of Princess Diana, or the media attention with celebrities of the past, it's treated as though it were somehow or another a national trauma. But it's not; these are not consequential events in the same way as 9/11. Or even the Oklahoma City bombing.
So at some points there may even be a kind of a desire to share in the mythos of tragedy, even when it's largely without consequence.
Well I think that's true, and it's in part because of the identification with celebrities that occurs in modern society, that we tend to have a lot of celebrities and very few heroes. And this is partly why the astronaut becomes so important as a new form of American hero.
Arthur Miller, so we don't leave this just way up in the media web. Let's bring it down to a very personal level, if you can, in your own personal life, in the personal exchanges in your life in the last 2 years. Can you feel a pain, a trauma, a confusion in fellow Americans that you speak with, the intimate relationships you have? Do you feel it?
Tom, you said Arthur Miller, so you could be...
I'm sorry, Arthur Neal, excuse me.
Okay. Well, let me respond to that.
So, thank you, Toby.
So the way in which I look at national trauma generally, it becomes important to raise the question as to whether it's an acute trauma of relatively short duration, like the Kennedy assassination and the Cuban Missile Crisis, or whether it's a chronic crisis in the sense that it's enduring, it's ongoing, and it's simply not going to go away. So the Challenger explosion was really an acute crisis of relatively short duration. Mm-hmm. The terrorist attack on 9/11 really threw us into a condition of chronic crisis because of the complexity of modern society. It's subject to disruption.
And is the impact of a chronic crisis different?
The impact of a chronic crisis is different because it's simply ongoing, and there's no apparent way of obtaining closure to it. You know, it's just like the crisis of capitalism is built into the Great Depression. It was ended only with a Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
I almost feel as though that chronic character of the 9/11 crisis, the tale that will not go away, is contributing to the sense of things piling on, because there remains this baseline, chronic crisis, as you call it, that doesn't go away. Tony's calling from Innsbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been incredibly jaded by all of this, and what really struck me as strange this weekend was that my wife told me that this had happened, and I turned on the news, and I watched it for a few minutes, and then all of a sudden, a few minutes later, I realized I had changed the channel, and I was looking at something else, and I realized, I can't believe that I'm so jaded that it didn't even keep my attention enough that I switched to something else.
So you were not prepared to be transfixed by this. Is that healthy or not, in your own mind, Tony?
Oh, it seems very unhealthy, and I have a 5-week-old child. I'm a first-time father, and mm-hmm. I was holding this child around 10 o'clock at night Saturday evening, and all of a sudden, I just happened to look on my computer. I happened to go to a website and check out the news, and then they had pictures of these people, and they showed them as fathers and mothers and things, and all of a sudden, it sort of dawned on me that these are people, you know, these people are national heroes, and I sort of just blew it off. I just walked away from the whole thing, and when the Challenger exploded, I remember exactly where I was. I was horrified by that, and this, as horrifying as it is, it didn't really cut into my own psyche until I really thought about it.
There may be the beginnings of a callus growing there. Tony, congratulations on that new child. Long and happy life. Toby Miller, is it possible that as the sense of accumulated woe goes on, if indeed that's what it is, that we become inured, that we become numbed in some degree?
Oh, absolutely. If you go back to the classical theorists of drama, I'm thinking of Aristotle, when Aristotle talked about how drama on stage could inure people to the power of violence, could stop them having a fellow feeling for their humans. This was a concern really thousands of years ago. Mm. The other thing is, I think, that if you look at even the coverage of basketball or the coverage of movie stars, the celebrities that Arthur spoke of, again and again and again, we have news anchors, interviewers, and others in the media talking about feelings. How did you feel today? Mm-hmm. Was God with you? What was it like? How would you like to tell us about your emotions? And this is just an overload. It is the form of analysis of a vast amount of U.S. current affairs, a vast amount of so-called factual TV programs.
Boiled down to emotion. I want to get one more call. Peter's calling. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Yes.
Good evening.
Hi.
I'm the director of a trauma program in Boston, Mass., and I'm struck by how the central aspect of post-traumatic stress is recurring memories of the traumatic event, and how if the media acts as sort of our national memory, our collective memory, as mm-hmm. it were, how this may be not just a factor of marketing, but also a natural sort of collective psychological phenomenon. This is what we do to heal, but the healing process isn't in necessarily the reliving of the memory over and over again.
Is it adults or children you deal with, Peter?
Children primarily.
And so does the media become an echo chamber of trauma that exacerbates the trauma?
I think if there's not some resolution to it, it can exacerbate it. So it is both a natural part of what we do with trauma, but it also is it can be harmful if it goes on and we don't have any resolution.
Peter, our time is running out, so I'm going to have to thank you at that, but thanks for the observation. Arthur Neal, a final thought. There's a concern that we never escape in the media echo chamber.
Well, his point is a very good one about the impact of traumatic memories. That it takes the form of an imprinting, and there's just no way of ever completely getting rid of it. So in terms of Americans who were alive at the time of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, it had such an impact on them that it's simply not going to change during their lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So it's why trauma has more of an effect on younger generations, those between the age of 15 and 24. Are impacted most significantly.
Arthur Neal, that sounds like we may need to devote an hour to that some evening, but we're out of time tonight. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Arthur Neal is author of National Trauma and Collective Memory, Major Events in the American Century. And Toby Miller, professor of cultural studies at New York University, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
President Bush led thousands of mourners today in a solemn memorial service for the 7 astronauts who died Saturday aboard the Space Shuttle Columbia. The astronauts were eulogized by their NASA colleagues. A U.S. Navy band sang hymns. The ceremony ended with a missing man flyover by 4 NASA jets. We're going to close this hour with sounds from that memorial service.
To leave behind Earth and air and gravity is an ancient dream of humanity. For these 7, it was a dream fulfilled. Each of them knew that great endeavors are inseparable from great risks. And each of them accepted those risks willingly, even joyfully, in the cause of discovery.
Rick, Willie, Mike, Casey, Laurel, Dave, and Alon, I know you're listening. Please know you are in our hearts, and we will always smile when we think of you.
America's space program will go on. This cause of exploration and discovery is not an option we choose. It is a desire written in the human heart. We are that part of creation which seeks to understand all creation. We find the best among us, send them forth into unmapped darkness, and pray they will return. They go in peace for all mankind, and all mankind is in their debt.
Last Wednesday, as the Columbia crew was circling the globe, Kolpnut took a rest from her duties to take in the stunning view of the Earth at sunset, a view that only a select group of space explorers have been privileged to witness. Now, she told us from the flight desk that the entire Earth and sky could be seen reflected in the retina of her eye. She called her crewmates to come over to see this amazing sight. It is this image, the image of Columbia's crew joyfully joining Kolpnut to see our beautiful planet reflected in their friend's eye, that we will remember and treasure forever. And for these, and for them, and their memories, we will persevere.
The final days of their own lives were spent looking down upon this Earth. And now on every continent, in every land they could see, the names of these astronauts are known and remembered. They will always have an honored place in the memory of this country. And today, I offer the respect and gratitude of the people of the United States.
Sounds from today's memorial service honoring the 7 astronauts who died Saturday aboard the Space Shuttle Columbia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.